This is Jason Embry. I used to get up early in the morning and do first reading. Now I get up early and do first feeding. And I'm here to introduce this week's Tribcast. Based on the other Tribcasting I've listened to, here's a preview. Jay's voice will grow increasingly louder and higher. Ross will refer to a movie you've never seen or heard of. Everything will be Ree's fault. Ben will laugh at his own joke. Evan will profess his mad love for Wilco. And someone will gratuitously name drop Makoviak. And now, the Tribcast.
Thank you, Jason. This is Ree with the Tribcast for the last week of June. Joining me is executive editor Ross Ramsey.
As soon as the kids are grown up, Jason, you'll be able to see more movies and you can catch up on your podcast.
Which movie do you think you'll reference this week?
I don't know yet.
Oh, well, we look forward to it. Editor Emily Ramshaw.
Hello there. I think Embry prefers his feedings to his readings.
Probably right.
I believe that was a reference to his recently born children.
We hope so.
Let's hope.
He's not just binging every morning. And CEO and editor-in-chief Evan Smith.
My assumption is that his experience in dealing with immature babies will serve him well working in the legislature.
But
is that right? Well, he made me last of three. I have nothing. I'm sorry. I was ordinarily he introduced me first. Also, hi, I'm Reeve.
Yeah, the Tribcast listeners
are
pretty close at this point.
The intimacy of the Tribcast is now just with first name. It's first names only.
The really Tribcast listener knows who he is now.
I know Jason and Makoviak.
All three of them.
So, I mean, I think that covers the spectrum of the listeners here. All right, well, this week we're going to talk about the Senate debates, which I believe Ross in particular has some experience with.
I may have been the only viewer.
Or you only attendee.
Right. And you were forced to view it.
Right. Couldn't leave.
Do you think the other moderators weren't viewing?
Questions about it.
Peggy Feacock had those glasses on that had the eyeballs painted on the outside.
Right. Everybody thought she was awake. That's right.
And we'll talk about some higher ed issues for those that have been following the University of Virginia and how it relates to Texas. But let's get started with the Senate debate first, I think. Which of the two debates now, had the Republican and the Democrat, was more interesting?
Well, the Democrats were interesting because they talked, you know, they actually were talking about issues and they weren't sort of barking at each other. The Republican debate has come down, or the Republican race for Senate has come down to this thing where there are virtually no differences on policy or on political standing. It's all sort of name-calling and style. And, you know, there was one question in there. We asked them, how would Senator Dewhurst vote differently than Senator Cruz? And they couldn't come up with an answer. As near as I could tell, the biggest difference was that one would repeal every word of Obamacare and the other one would repeal every syllable of Obamacare. And you know, it was all just talking points and
whoever listened to it on audiobook.
Right.
By the way, we'll have a good New York Times story this weekend about the very few differences between the two and their positions. I think we, you know, came up with four different positions where they have sort of slight differences in opinion.
Right. They're just really sort of mad at each other right now. You know, I don't think they could have shaken hands at the beginning of the debate standing further apart than they did. It was like they sort of, you know, stood and leaned and shook hands. It was just the body language was pretty incredible.
But I have to say that as somebody who cares about this stuff, and so I'm predisposed to watch it, I was nonetheless...
Nothing going on for you Friday night, huh?
Hell no.
I wasn't the only one tweeting. Evan must have been sitting on his couch.
Well, I was just really put off by, on the one hand, how rabid Cruz seemed to be. Mm-hmm. You know, he seemed... The foam was spewing from his mouth. He just seemed angry at Dewhurst and angry at Obama, and it was the opposite of Reagan. You know, conservatism with a smile, or kind of the happy warrior. There was no happy in that warrior on Friday night. On the other hand, Lieutenant Governor, who's been a statewide office holder
since 98,
is continuing to have a problem with subject, verb, object. He was not a very articulate spokesperson for himself or for conservatism or for anything.
No, I mean, the way I used to get watching Rick Perry debate, where you sort of, you know, just cringe and wait, I found myself doing that a little bit watching Dewhurst. You know, he hasn't had any of those big blunders. But again, you know, the level of eloquence is really different between those two
guys. And look, we're not electing an orator. We're electing a senator.
Right.
So maybe the fact that Dewhurst wasn't a terribly gifted, or I'm thinking of the word gifted, good.
We hired him,
and then he became the thing.
I did become the thing.
Plus, he was before.
It's like people who begin to look like their dogs.
Right. You know? Everyone, we hired an editor, not an orator.
An orator. Ordinarily, I can do a sentence.
Well, there were a couple places,
but
in the debate where
he didn't seem gifted or particularly interested in the art of this. He really seemed to be just getting through it.
It struck me as he'd been briefed. Don't make a mistake. Don't make news. And he seemed to be very, very restrained the whole time. There were a couple of times where Cruz said something provocative, and you could, you know, I don't know how this came off on TV, but in the studio you could actually see Dewhurst wanting to react to what Cruz had said, and at the same time sort of, you know, the little voice in the back of his head going, don't make news, and
right,
you know, just kind of locking up.
Well, it seemed like the biggest news actually came from that moment after the debate when Cruz made his comment about why is Perry backing Dewhurst, and he said it's in his political interest to get Dewhurst out of the state, basically,
and to get him out of Austin.
That did not seem to go well with the governor.
But you're right, it did fall into the sort of angry vein of all of his comments where Cruz's, you know, remarks were sort of so fiery and so pissed.
Right.
This is becoming, by virtue of the campaign staff that has surrounded Dewhurst in these last couple of weeks, this is becoming as much a Cruz versus Perry race as it is a Cruz versus Dewhurst race. There is nothing that Dewhurst has said or done that has distinguished him from Perry. He and Perry are locked at the hips. And if you remember, go back to the beginning of the campaign, back months and months and months ago, after the session, when Dewhurst finally acknowledged what we all knew was the case, that he was running for the Senate. In one of those early videos, he lashed himself to Perry.
Right.
And the arrival of Mark Minor on top of Rob Johnson at the Super PAC, on top of Dave Carney.
Right. Same characters.
This is effectively the Perry guys trying to get Dewhurst to the Senate. Now, Cruz is associating a motivation with the governor that, you know, clearly the governor's not going to say, well, yeah, the reason I want to do this is because I want Dewhurst moved out. I'm not sure that that the governor, by the way, is going to get a better deal in the Senate if Dewhurst is not there.
Well, Dewhurst did this thing where he lashed himself to the governor, but he lashed himself to the Rick Perry who beat Kay Hutchison and not to the Rick Perry that ran the presidential race. And he went through this thing where, you know, Perry ran as the anti-establishment, anti-Washington candidate, and clobbered Kay Hutchison because she was the establishment candidate. And he's managed now to lash himself to Perry and to be sort of the Kay Bailey Hutchison in this race. You know, Cruz has taken the role that Perry had in the last governor's race.
But is there any way it ends up good for Perry? If he loses, then he's lost sort of two races in a row. If Dewhurst loses, then the Perry folks will have
to. I don't think it'll hang on Perry. I think it'll hang on Dewhurst. If Dewhurst loses this race, he started with a bazillion simoleons. He started with all of the political establishment.
Yeah,
Nobody would give money to anybody else.
I agree with that.
This was
his race to lose.
Right. It still is his race to lose. Yeah. I mean, as bad as it looks at the moment, you know, and I think Cruz
but see,
has
but
gotten.
But do you think it looks bad at the moment?
I do.
Aman Bethija, who is, of course, covering this race for us as a reporter on the ground, well, not. He's not
Ross,
who flies in with his cape and his, you know,
yeah, my cape, yeah,
and his
right.
M for moderator, I'm or questioner, whatever.
What's your favorite movie with a cape?
I'll come back to it. The Incredibles.
Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
Evan's actually thinking about it.
Aman and I were talking about this morning, and you know, what is the likely prognosis for this race right now? What's the likely outcome? I don't think anybody really knows. There are people who will say to you this. In fact, one did say to me, somebody I regard highly, who knows about these things, is usually right about these predictions, said, it's over. Cruz has won. It's over. Just forget about it. It's over.
I know that guy. He's wrong.
Who's doing any polling?
Not me.
Just the campaigns, I think.
Just the campaigns. But on the other hand, I actually think that the farther Cruz gets away from the narrative of these upstart candidates defeating these establishment candidates, I just don't know that is there really a momentum behind Cruz? I feel more today than I did a week ago that the outcome of this race is a toss-up.
So early voting, Dewhurst got 48%. The other three major candidates, Leppert, Cruz, and Craig James fellow, all combined for less than 48%. On election day, Dewhurst had fallen to 40, 31%. Cruz was up to 38%. And it's not necessarily a time series. You could have different populations of voters and all of that. But I think that's the trend of that race. The two things that are going to, you know, I think be influential in this are how they come back after the July 4th break. You know, next week's sort of busted in half.
Yeah.
How they come back after that break and whether they can get any kind of airtime around the Olympics, you know, which sort of precedes the July 31st election. And
your point is that the Olympics are going to suck all the energy out of television.
Right. I think everybody's going to be talking about gymnastics and not about Senate races.
But again, your point on the Cruz election day total, I think, is in some ways tied to the point that I made. I think that at the moment of the primary, you were just coming out of Indiana and Nebraska, and the momentum was with Cruz. My point is, the farther you get away from those precipitating events, I wonder if that momentum slows.
Well, it depends on who votes. I mean, if
it depends
if,
on how China does in the Olympics.
And are there more debates, or is this it?
There's one more debate in Houston on July 17th.
It's a below debate.
I think so. I think it's KHOU, and yep. I want to say it's July 17th.
I mean, and do people watch any of these? I mean,
no, they read the news the next day and see if the debate made any news.
Yeah.
Right.
Then they, unless they're
evident. Well, highlight reel. We watch them,
but we're paid to.
But we're paid to watch.
And the Democratic debate, anything terribly interesting in that? The there was that weird line about
the Berlin Wall.
The Berlin Wall.
You know, I mean, it's one of those races where you've got a guy who's, you know, run a couple of races but never has really contended, Grady Yarborough. And Paul Sadler, who was a...
Is Grady Yarborough even an actual candidate?
Apparently.
Well, yeah.
He has one ad.
Yeah, and he's not, you know, I mean, he's not nobody. He's not, I mean, we've seen people pop up that...
He isn't nobody?
We've seen, well, he's...
To Evan, he's nobody.
No, I'm asking...
He is nobody. He's not an empty vessel. Let me put it
in a
different
way. I'm asking in a kind of like existential sense.
In an existential sense, they're both nobodies in some ways. You know, Paul Sadler has been a state rep, but he's unknown. And, you know, when we did the polling on this race, 75 or 80% of people's first round answer
was,
I don't have a preference in this race because I don't know who those guys are.
It illustrates the problem of being in the legislature because at most, a couple hundred thousand people know who you are.
And in particular, he was in the legislature 10 years ago. So anyway, so they did this debate, and one of Yarbrough's answers was that one of the ways to solve the problem of immigration was to build, you know, we had that, I hate to bring it up, he said, but we had that wall in Berlin.
And it worked.
And it worked, yeah.
Great.
I think you got shot if you crawled over it. And I think that was my memory of it.
Small
yeah, but if someone, if Cruz or Dewhurst had said that, that would have been major news.
Well, and East...
The Berlin Wall?
Well, yeah, and that goes to Evan's point. If this guy was a serious candidate, considered a serious candidate, it would have been a huge deal. And it's not like East Germany was a trading partner.
You know, one of the few differences between Cruz and Dewhurst is the extent of which they think there needs to be walling or fencing.
Right, right.
Who's on which side of that divide?
Of that fence?
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly. Well, we'll have to read on Friday in the New York Times to find out.
I thought Cruz was...
Cruz thinks it's a continuous wall from sea to shining sea.
He's more fency or wally.
Fency or wally.
Dewhurst thinks it ought to be strategically placed walls here and there.
Maybe Wally was our movie name drop.
But the Democratic debate was interesting, and I was thinking afterwards that it would be interesting, even though it is a Republican state, and even though that if you put Sadler or Yarbrough or any Democrat who's been interested in this with the Republicans, they're going to be too liberal for most of the electorate. But it would be interesting to throw them into the debate because at least you'd be talking about or questioning some of these issues, and Dewhurst and Cruz would have to defend themselves on issues rather than, you know, on how they ran their ads.
I had a conversation the other day with a Democratic office holder. Obviously,
in
I'm not
what
talking
state?
About a statewide office holder. Yes, Bernie Sanders and I were having coffee. I was in Vermont. No, with a Texas Democrat in elective office in the legislature who observed that he believed that Sadler had done a very poor job of putting himself out there as a candidate both in the run-up to the primary and has done so similarly poorly in the wake of the primary day in the run-up to the runoff. And said, you know, the missed opportunity here is most of us, this Democrat said, thought that Dewhurst would walk away with this, and so nobody considered seriously the prospect of running.
Right.
He said, but if Cruz wins the primary, there are people in the Republican Party who view Cruz as 2-2.
Right.
Yeah, but 2-2 over a D?
Well, but if the
which D,
but
right?
The idea is which.
Right. Yeah.
So if a serious Democrat with an ability to appeal to conservative.
You got like
voters,
a John Sharp type.
I think this person was thinking exactly. So let's assume
Tim Kaine, John
let's
Sharp.
Say,
somebody
let's
like
say
that.
John Sharp is the Democratic candidate for Senate at this point. He's presumably competitive on some levels against either one, but particularly he might be competitive more so than the average Democrat has been against someone who is perceived by some of the Republican Party to be a little bit too.
But isn't that one of the speculations about why it might have been advantageous to get him in that chancellor position in the first place? Sort of get the major.
Well, yeah, and Sharp
Democrat
wasn't going to run against Dewhurst. He already lost that fight. You know, he already, you know, if the presumption going into this is that Dewhurst is going to win it, and
on.
If you've already lost an election to Dewhurst, then, you know, why would you do that?
But why would Sharp have put himself out there as a candidate for the Senate in a nominal sense twice before these sort of stop-start campaigns when they all thought Kaye's going to go away? If he didn't think he would be running, who did he think he'd be running
against? Well, you throw a hook in the water and see if anybody buys. You throw a hook in the water and see if anybody buys. Is there any support for an alternative to whoever you think's running? I mean, that's as old as politics. You just say, you know, anybody interested? Nope, nobody interested. I think I'll go back to this.
Well, the point is that Sadler is not making it. Was the perception of this?
Well, their big plan was to run Sanchez.
Elected person.
Richard. Am I missing the name?
Rick. The general from Iraq.
Yeah.
And
then. His house burned down over Thanksgiving, and he decided not to run. And so Sadler said, "Okay, I'll run." And that's pretty much the campaign he's run. It's sort of an "Okay, I'll run."
How would he have done though?
I think he would have got clobbered. I think it's a Republican state, and I think that calculation going into this, both from the point of the candidates and the point of view of the funders, was: look, Bill White may have not been the best candidate, but it was a completely well-funded, professionally run campaign, and it only got 43-44%. Why am I throwing money at that? Right. Why am I throwing my career at that? And I think that's the frame everybody entered this election in.
So if you were going to put the blame, you know, if blame is the right word, on the fact that Sadler only raised, yeah, I mean, he's even 70, commented 70, on like his 70,
right.
Yeah, $70,000 heading into the primary. Is that his fault, the party's fault,
reality's fault?
It's his fault.
It's the party's fault.
It's first his fault because he hasn't done the things that you need to do in order to at least say, look, I made the case to those people and they turned me down. He didn't make the case. You have to make the case. You have to ask those people for that money. You got to work your tail off, and if it doesn't come, then you can criticize them. You can't just sit there and wait for it to happen to you. That's not how politics works.
But at what point is the Democratic Party's responsibility to field a candidate and to support that candidate? I mean, how much? What was the number?
The question 70,000?
A little more than 70,000.
How do you define the Democratic Party?
Right.
Is the Democratic Party the actual previously Boyd Ritchie led, now Alberto Hinojosa led party, or is it Democrats in a flat hierarchical sense?
It doesn't look to me like Sadler. This is probably unfair, but it doesn't look to me like Sadler got into this race with a business plan that said.
I think it's entirely fair.
We're going to do this.
Fair.
We're going to do this. We're going to do this. And if you haven't done that, then you can't really criticize the people who didn't respond to the business plan you didn't have.
The other way to look at this is, and we have said some version of this before on this podcast, is. The Democrats are the third party in a two-party state right now.
I think Jay has put it best in previous podcasts.
His voice was very high when he did it.
Dead.
Right.
The Democrats really don't have any stroke right now as a party statewide. And so in some ways, maybe the burden we're placing on Sadler is unreasonable. Because if you're Paul Sadler, or for that matter, any Democrat attempting to mount a statewide campaign, the last chapter is written. Barring some cataclysmic event on the other side, the last chapter is written before you begin. And the two parties of the two-party state are the Tea Party and what we used to think of before it was a pejorative as the moderate wing or the business conservative wing of the party, where they don't agree with everything that the Tea Party wing thinks on social issues and some other issues. And that really is the way that the primary and the Republican side is playing out. Right?
Right.
I mean, Dewhurst would shudder to think that someone would dare describe him in this environment as a moderate. But there's no question that the critique of Dewhurst has been that he is too reflective of that old definition of a Republican.
Right.
Right. It's not because that he's worked with Democrats on some issues.
But again, we would say, and anybody, I would challenge anybody to say differently, what would a more conservative lieutenant governor have done and accomplished that Dewhurst did not? Dewhurst has been a very conservative lieutenant governor over these three sessions.
Right.
He has.
Right.
And so I'm not certain what given the nature of the job, he's done that's not adequately conservative. Only by the standards of Texas at this moment would he not be considered sufficiently conservative.
Right.
What do you speaking of the Democratic Party being the third party, obviously they're trying to rebuild themselves with their new chairman. One of the issues he's decided to get out way in front on, sort of out of the gate, is legalizing marijuana, which seems to be an interesting play if you're like really trying to build a base that isn't there.
I think he'll win the early vote in Travis Hunt's.
Yeah.
That issue was cropped up a bit, though. I was in the Beto O'Rourke race as well.
Yeah, I mean, Beto would say, you know, careful on that. That's not exactly what I meant. You know, he's talked about decriminalization is the word as opposed to legalization, you know, making penalties less, right, but not, you know, opening the door for it.
Right.
Every time anybody mentions him and legalization, he, you know, wants to
he
walk
didn't
it
exactly,
back.
He didn't exactly run as Dimebag Beto. Right. And I think he's reluctant at this point.
The Oat Willie candidate.
To be associated. Yeah. He's reluctant to be associated with that issue expressly. I think he sees the challenge from a branding standpoint going into Congress.
I do believe after he won, he was the banner picture on the Huffington Post saying, like,
printed on hemp,
marijuana legalizer.
I will say that I would not expect him to do a photo shoot for High Times anytime soon.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, maybe pot is a good segue into college. Right?
Only for Reeve.
Okay. Okay, Reeve.
Not for me. I'm just saying. We have to make a segue somehow.
Fine. Only for Ross.
Yeah. Right. Move on.
Yeah. So obviously the big news in higher ed nationally this week was the reinstatement after the deinstatement, I guess, the ousting of University of Virginia President Teresa Sullivan, former UT administrator. I know Evan was following this, and maybe he has.
I was counting the number of UT administrators mentioned in all these stories, because you had Richard LaRiviere, the former dean of liberal arts at UT, who was at University of
Oregon,
who was fired this year. You had Bill Powers, obviously, ever and perpetually in some peril, as you reported this morning at the Tribune. You know, the analogy is being made between Texas and Virginia as far as the actions of the overseers of Virginia and what could or could not befall Powers here. I thought the Sullivan thing was interesting, and I think how humiliating it must have been for the people running that university to have to completely reverse their decision and not, you know, unanimously.
Including the people who had ousted her.
If you're Teresa Sullivan, I mean, I have to wonder if I'm Teresa Sullivan, how bad do I want that job?
Yeah,
to come back knowing the environment. I mean, these people were prepared to humiliate me and
can
me.
I think she comes back as a victor. She completely she swallowed her board of regents.
Do you think she's impenetrable now?
Yeah. Yes. I think she won. I think she had the student body, the faculty, the alumni were all behind her. The governor was in trouble because the politics of this were all on her side. The regents, or whatever they call them, the, you know, board of visitors.
Board of visitors,
right.
Yeah.
They completely got swallowed on this. The governor, the day before they voted to reinstate her, said, you know, I'm not going to tell you what decision you should make. It's a decision you should make.
And if
you don't make the decision, none of you has a job the next day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what's interesting, obviously, when the power stuff was going on a few weeks back or however long that was.
About a month and change. Well, it depends on what you mean by the stuff. The month and change was that Burka blog post.
Right. And I'm talking about, you know, the sort of pseudo Facebook stuff that now turns out to have sort of been a little bit of a scam. All these Facebook pages that allegedly had so many members or so many friends. But I think, you know, what that shows is how far could it have gotten in Texas? I mean, you know, was the outcry, let's say they had ousted Powers or tried to oust Powers, was the outcry going to be enough to prompt a Virginia
the thing is that there have been people ousted over these sorts of issues of the regents want to come in and make changes and people aren't making the changes they want and the speed they want. You know, McKinney was pushed out as the chancellor of A&M. David Pryor, an executive chancellor at executive vice chancellor at UT, sort of was quietly retired. It hasn't happened to a Powers figure in Texas yet.
So if you are a UT regent, what and maybe an anti-Powers UT regent, what message do you take away from what happened in Virginia?
You better make sure that gun's loaded. Yeah, I mean, you better make sure you've got every single thing lined up.
If you're going to shoot, if you're going to shoot the king, you better kill the king.
Right.
You have to make one of the problems that the people in Virginia ran into was that after they pushed her out, they tried to defend it in sort of the vaguest, most general terms, like, oh, well, online classes. We need more online classes, and
they didn't really have a story,
right?
So you need, you need to have a compelling reason and case to make.
I think it matters that they were messing with Thomas Jefferson's university, and that there's a tradition at UVA that, I mean, Longhorns and Aggies are loyal to their schools and everything, but UVA has this sort of nationwide thing, and it's really big in the legal community. It's really big in sort of the government and power communities. And I just think that if you don't line up your politics on these kinds of things, as that board of visitors has found out,
here's a question: if the Regents voted to fire Bill Powers, and there was an outcry in the state of Texas similar to the outcry in the state of Virginia, show of hands, how many people believe that Rick Perry would do a Bob McDonald?
And tell him to recall it?
Oh. Well, none of us have our hands up, just for you out there.
Well, Perry,
because I don't think that the board of rectors or whatever the name of this weird organization that it's not
it's the board of visitors. It's headed by the rector.
By the rectors. So whatever these people do, it's damn people, whoever they are.
Let that one go.
The difference is that those. That's okay. Todd let it out. The difference is that those.
Well, Todd doesn't know how to edit. We just keep him here.
He just sits here, smokes his gourd, whatever he does. Right. The difference is that the people in Virginia were not necessarily acting in concert with the governor. If the Regents were to act here, the assumption, proven or unproven, would be that they're acting in concert with the governor, that they were in fact acting upon the governor's wishes.
I think if you were a regent, if you were in a position of. You know, whatever you call your governing board, and you didn't check with your governor.
Rector,
you're an idiot. If you're doing this right and you're checking your politics, you touch base with your governor.
Yeah,
you touch base with all of those people, and if you don't, you know, you deserve whatever happens to you. You're not playing the game right.
But but it should be said, the Sullivan thing obviously is not precedent setting in any way. I mean, not the La Riviere case. I mean, he had tons of support, and he's now the head of the Field Museum. I mean, he was gone. Which is easily happening. I mean, obviously, I think the support generally has been overwhelmingly in Powers' favor, and yet sort of the rumors persist. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing is, some of those rumors may be sort of persisting because of the degree of paranoia among some of his supporters.
This is one of those things where I think if you're attacked and you win, you're in a much stronger position than when you started. It's kind of the J. Edgar Hoover rule. You know, if they try to knock you off and they don't, then you're there almost as long as you want to be.
Unless you're Tom Craig.
Well, he survived for a long time.
He did.
You survive until you don't.
Right. And Sullivan's in a really good position. And, you know, if Powers went the same way, Powers would be, you know, there is, you know.
I think this Tribcast maybe has survived
until it can't.
We need a rector to come in and tell us that we're done.
Stop visiting.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then, if you have questions or comments about any of these things or anything else, you can email tribcast@texastribune.org. On behalf of Evan, Emily, Ross, our producer Todd, this is Reeve Hamilton. Thanks for listening.
Roy Scheider's best movie?
Jaws is a better movie than all that jazz. All that Jaws. Two movies for the price of one. All that Jaws.
That is awesome.
Roy Scheider dances and then someone says, we need a bigger boat or something like that, right?
What's